This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald.
I'm Ramya Amadhin, and this is Kelly and Ramya.
Live from the Accessible Media Studios, this is Kelly and Ramya. Entertainment, lifestyle, and great conversation. It's AMI's on-air community, and everyone's invited.
Midweek, we've hit it here on Kelly and Ramya. Kelly McDonald, Kelly. And in the meantime, I'm Ramya Amadhin with Grant Hardy for the remainder of this week at least. We'll flip things around a little next week, but it's going to be a fun time. We've got a good lineup for you. But Grant, I wanted to ask you, because lately I've been flipping a lot back and forth between using my laptop, the standard butterfly keys on the MacBook, then using a Bluetooth keyboard, so the Mini Magic keys, and then using my iMac at home. Just not being able to have just a one standard keyboard life right now. So I'm curious for you, how picky are you with your keyboards?
Yeah, I guess probably not as picky as I should be. I think just to start with, the whole business about laptops is probably not as ergonomic for our hands and our bodies as it should be, right? You should have a, you know, in theory, we'd all have a great big, you know, desktop set up everywhere. We'd have a keyboard, put it exactly the right height. Wouldn't be too high, too low, or too hot or cold with the heat of the computer. So yeah, I think we've probably all slipped into some habits that maybe we shouldn't have, and I'm definitely guilty of that. I'm, you know, typing on the screen of my iPhone is probably terrible for my fingers. You know, sometimes I'll just put a computer on my lap or on a surface where it doesn't really work. So I guess no, but I would like to be more picky.
Yeah. Did you ever go through like phases of I need a mechanical keyboard, or I need this, or I need that? Our friend Mike Fair is, like, at least once a year, it feels, on some kind of keyboard search, is a hunt for the best keyboard situation.
Yeah, I can't say that. I will say that after years and years of ignoring it, I did switch to Braille screen input on the iPhone.
Nice.
Which takes a lot of time to kind of orientate to and master, but now that I have it, I do type quite a lot quicker.
Okay.
How about you? Any sort of keyboard kick that you've been on?
Not really, but I will say I despise not using a full keyboard. I need the numpad, and that is reason more than the actual type of keys or the physical feel of keys. Without a numpad, I feel like the laptop is just such a strain. Because of, you know,
interesting.
Yeah, shortcuts and hotspots with the Mac and things like that. I prefer just to have the numpad available. All right. Let's see what else.
I don't know if I've ever used a numpad on
really?
The Mac, actually. I'll have to give it a try.
Oh, my iMac. Like you said, the iMac stationary experience, not the iMac specifically, but, you know, the stationary experience is the best, the desktop. And for me, that's because you get a full keyboard.
Ooh, good tip.
There you go. All right, let's see what else is coming up on today's Wednesday edition of Kelly and Ramya. We have Corinne Van Duzen joining us for an entertainment report, and she's got highlights from the iHeart Music Awards, behind-the-scenes look at vocal performances on the set of Wicked the movie as well.
Community reporter Vic Pereira brings us the latest from Winnipeg, including a volunteer recruitment event with more than 50 nonprofits looking to get people involved.
Very nice. Also, AMI's HR business partner, Alicia Yardley, is joining us. She's going to help us expel the anxiety around performance reviews at work and shares what we stand to gain as employees from a talent system. The US FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, says some over-the-counter pain creams could pose health problems.
The FDA is advising consumers to stay away from a series of topical pain relief products used before, during, and after procedures like tattooing, piercing, and laser hair removal. The FDA sent warning letters to six companies, TXTX, CNext Venture, Tattoo Numbing Cream Company, Painless Tattoo Company, Dermal Source, and Ink Easy. Some of these companies' products have higher than permitted levels of the painkiller lidocaine. Brian Clark, ABC News.
The first part that struck me is I'm not even sure how normal it is, normalized or typical it is for people to utilize these creams before and after tattooing. I myself, who has several experiences getting tatted, have never used any of this. And I'm not even saying that as a brag. I'm just saying that it's not like typical. It's not something that the artist has asked me of or recommended or suggested or, you know, like we're all gnashing our teeth in pain, but he's never said, hey, do you want a painkiller? So I was very curious about, you know, just the number of labels that were mentioned in this clip, Grant, because clearly the stuff is out there.
Yeah, it's not really surprising if you think about the amount of different substances, human-made, that we use and the amount of pressure, especially in the U.S., that people are under to kind of get things approved, keep things on the market, keep things sold, you know, prescribe different whatever it is or have it over-the-counter. It really doesn't particularly surprise me, to be honest, that the line between sort of like what's safe in the short term versus the long term kind of blurs a little bit.
Yeah, especially when it comes to things like painkillers. Topical, I'm not sure. I'm just saying anecdotally, topical pain creams and such feel like that, exactly what you said, that line is super gray. And it's not even like, how much are you supposed to know about these things, right? You're just going and picking up whatever is either A, recommended to you, or B, that you find that somebody else has said, yeah, that's what they use, you know, or C, hopefully you have an actual conversation with a pharmacist or somebody, even if it is over the counter. But regardless, like I said, there were so many mentioned here that I'd never even heard of as options, but they're there, kind of like lozenges, you know, like you don't necessarily think too much about what you're taking. Just, I got a sore throat, there are five different options here, I'll just grab what I can get.
We're either scientists or we go 100% by trust and what other people tell us to get.
Exactly. And what's been popularized or out there for years. Okay. Well, that's something to keep in mind. Let's take a break and come back for headlines with you, Grant Hardy. We're going to talk about Canada's federal minimum wage. It's set to increase to $17.30 next week. We're going to talk about what that means when we come back. This is Kelly and Ramia.
Don't miss a minute. Kelly and Ramia will be right back.
Tune into Kelly and Ramia on AMI TV, AMI Audio, or your favorite podcast platform. Today, we've got me, Ramia Amuddin, and Grant Hardy joining us, and we'll be holding down the fort for the rest of the week. Grant, what do we have next?
It is time to talk entertainment. Let's bring on Corinne Van Dusen.
Hi, I'm Corinne Van Dusen. Join me as we dive into the latest entertainment stories from music, television, and movies here with Kelly and Ramia.
Hey, Corinne, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Grant. Always happy to be here.
All right. First up, we are talking about Beyoncé, and she is going to be honored with the iHeartRadio Innovator Awards. This is very cool. So the awards are really continuing for her. Can you talk about the Innovator Award? What is it exactly?
Well, Ramia is not going to be too surprised that Beyoncé is our first story.
Obviously.
And another name might come up during it, but we will see. Okay. The Innovator Award is given to the artist who is continuously contributing to pop culture and the music industry. So Beyoncé would sum that up. iHeartRadio describes the singer as a global cultural icon who has created music that has topped the charts across multiple formats while also architecting groundbreaking tours. So she gets out there, she writes, she sings, she dances, she puts together tours, she does movies. She is a, what is that? How do you say more than a quadruple threat, I would say.
Mm.
I know I can't think of a word for five. It's so true. And all of her music is so like different. You know what I mean? It's not like it's not repeated. Everything just has such a different vibe, no matter what the song is. She joins a pretty impressive list of past winners. Who are some of those?
Well, the names include Bruno Mars, Alicia Keys, Chance the Rapper, and who do I always talk about? Of course,
Taylor
Ramya.
Swift.
Taylor Swift.
The control room has been anticipating, wondering if her name would come up today.
Do you have to wonder? I don't think so.
Nah.
We'll go on a streak. We should have, you know, X amount of days when Taylor Swift has not been mentioned.
There you go.
What else is happening at the iHeartRadio Music Awards? What can we anticipate?
Well, they're going to be shown on Monday. Big music awards hosted by Ludacris. You'll also see performances from Justin Timberlake, Green Day, TLC, Canadian Tate McRae, who's all over the place now, which is exciting. Just won some Junos and more. And there's going to be another special tribute, not just the Innovator Award, but the Icon Award is going to Cher.
Oh, well, of course. Well deserving.
You said quite iconic.
Yeah, no kidding. You said Chance the Rapper was one of the past recipients of the Innovator Award?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Huge fan. Just wanted to double check.
Yeah. He had a... He kind of fell off the map. Like, I don't know if he went into more producing or not, but there was a time there where anything he touched turned to gold.
Absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
Was getting songs out there. He had, like, you know, fashion underway. He hosted and was a musical guest on Saturday Night Live. So, you know, at that time, I would say, yeah, he was definitely an innovator.
Right? And Ludacris is making a comeback, too, with these live performances. He was on there with Usher, right, for the... What was that?
For the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's between nice that and his Fast and Furious movies, you get a lot of Ludacris lately.
Exactly. Come bring him on. Like, I love Ludacris. Grew up with him.
Yeah, he's really talented.
Okay. So next up, Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo. Is that what you're saying?
Cynthia Erivo.
Yep. Erivo. Okay. Are proving to be the absolute professionals on the set of their movie Wicked, including singing all the vocals live. Okay. This is lit because usually there's a backup track, which, you know, have the vocals already recorded. That's what's used when people are recording movies, films, music videos, etc. But when it comes to singing scenes, so why did they choose to sing live? They just want to brag about it?
Well, Cynthia Erivo is a huge Broadway star. She sings, she does live music, and this is what she does. Ariana Grande, fantastic range, can sing live, can
incredible
do everything. They're the two lead characters. So Ariana Grande is playing Glinda the Good Witch, which is why she dresses in pink a lot. And then Cynthia Erivo is playing Elphaba, who is technically the Wicked Witch. Mm. I don't know if you've seen Wicked, the musical, but it is based on the story of that movie. Oh my gosh. You caught me.
Now you got me.
Now we're not going to be able to
think of it. Now we're not going to do it.
So the characters are Dorothy, Toto.
Yes. Why can't I? Why do I keep thinking of the soundtrack?
Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. People were yelling at their
TV. Wow, that was sad.
Sure.
Sorry, guys. On entertainment, nonetheless.
Nonetheless. It's not Taylor Swift. If she would. No. So Wicked is being directed by John M. Chu, and he told Vanity Fair, when we were shooting, those girls were like, and then he quotes them saying, expletive, the pre-records, we're going live. So that's what they do. And they were going to continue to do it even on a movie.
Yeah. I mean, they're incredible singers, right? Ariana Grande is. Sorry, I don't know the other person. Sorry, Shai. I know she's huge. But Ariana Grande is incredible live, so might as well do it up. And anything else on what the director thought of them doing this?
Well, he said initially he was skeptical of making the movie that way. And he told them it would be a lot of wind in their air pipes as they perform the movie's complex sequences. There's a lot of like flying through the air and different scenes and fantastical things. So they got to maintain their singing voices while doing all these this stuff. He said, nope, they persisted. They were like, yep, it's what we do. We're going to do it. We're going live.
Okay.
Very brave.
Yeah.
Really, isn't it?
I mean, it makes sense to have these question marks, especially because filming is different than doing it live on Broadway. Like, we're just not even really talking about the same thing. But then again, I think but they do it live on Broadway. So.
Yeah. Why not, right?
Yeah. Has it been done in any movies before?
Yes, actually. Okay. It's a process of recording the star's vocals has fallen in line with similar techniques that were used in Les Miserables, La La Land, and A Star is Born. I was reading about The Star is Born, and Lady Gaga was the one who started it, really, really pushed for it. In La La Land, they wanted everything mic'd live, all of the instruments and the singing. So that's why I believe it's one... nominated, possibly won Best Sound at the Oscars, because pulling that off is quite a feat.
Yeah.
I'll say. Speaking of movies, is it Beetlejuice? Is it Beetlejuice twice?
No. Oh, you said it three times. There you go. It is.
Okay, it is.
The sequel is Beetlejuice. Yeah.
So it's the first trailer for the highly anticipated sequel to Beetlejuice, the 1988 cult classic film by Tim Burton, has been released. Can you describe the trailer for Beetlejuice?
Yes, I can. Astra Dietz, who's Lydia Dietz's daughter, bikes around the quaint small town and then through the red-covered bridge that you know from the first movie. And then the cuts to four people at a funeral standing for an unidentified character. You don't know who the funeral is for. And they stand there while the casket's being lowered. A famous song from the first movie is Deo by Harriet Belafonte. And they have a choir singing it, like a melodious cover is what they say. So it's very like eerie and slow and you know, according to the movie. Cut to Astrid, who's in the attic of the family home. She stumbles upon a small figurine model of the town, which seemingly sets the titular character free, tearing it apart. And then after floating up from the miniature town, Beetlejuice finally makes his grand appearance saying, the juice is loose, and Lydia and Astrid watch in horror.
So I'm not familiar at all, actually, with the first movie. So I'm trying to imagine what this movie is going to really be about. Do we know based on that trailer? Do you have any sort of guess, like how this is going to go down?
We have the official write-up that was sent out to give you more of an idea. So it's after an unexpected family tragedy, three generations of the Dietz family return home, which is still haunted by Beetlejuice. And Lydia's life is turned upside down with her rebellious teenage daughter, Astrid, discovering the mysterious model of the town in the attic. And then a porthole to the afterlife is accidentally open. And that's when trouble starts brewing in both realms.
Wow. Sounds scary.
Who's
delinquent teenage daughter part.
who exactly is going to be in this movie?
Well, you got your regulars coming back. Michael Keaton's going to be playing Beetlejuice, and Catherine O'Hara, Winona Ryder, Jenna Ortega, and Justin Theroux are two new people on the screen. Now is a picture of Michael Keaton and the character he made famous as Beetlejuice, looking the same but a little older, so that's okay. I guess even demons can grow up.
Rami, are you familiar with the 1988 movie?
Only with the saying and the thing, but not at all. Are you looking forward to it, Corinne?
Oh yeah, we watched the original Beetlejuice this weekend after we saw the trailer.
Interesting.
So
in anticipation
that we've
or preparation, I should say.
Anticipation, yes.
When you say this, the saying, is that the juice is on the loose or whatever you said? Or what is the
no.
What is the saying?
Beetlejuice three times.
Okay. Yeah, the juice is loose. It's just Michael Keaton announcing he's back, but who knows? Maybe it'll catch on.
I was going to say, that'll be the second saying, right?
You watched the movie this weekend. What did you think of the 1988?
Well, I've seen it hundreds of times, so.
Wow, actually, you're not just exaggerating.
It's a favorite? Wow.
It's exaggerating is 100 times, but I've seen it over and over again, so I would be able to quote a lot and tell a lot about that movie. So it is exciting that, this many years later, they've decided to come back with these characters, and I'm interested to see what it's like, because it's a fantastical Tim Burton world. I don't know if you know the movies that Tim Burton does. He does dark stuff like the first Batmans with Michael Keaton stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to see with the technology we have today what he can do with aesthetics from back in the 80s.
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting point, because original movie 88, now we got all this and the changes and cast and like actual quality of film, right? Like, camera. So visually, do you think that it's going to be, like, based on the trailer and such, do you think that it's going to kind of have that seamless effect of a sequel?
I think so. It looks like it, because they've got everything correct. Like, the red barn-covered bridge is exactly like it was. The house is exactly like it was. They've got the model of the town. It's this huge model that they've redone impressively. The thing about the 88 movie, a lot of the stuff was claymation, because that's kind of what they had back then, or Tim Burton liked to use for special effects. So it'll be interesting to see if they bring stuff back, like, you know, the sandworms or other people who are in the afterworld realm, and what they use to do that.
Awesome. It's going to be great. Looking forward to it. Really quickly, when does the movie come out?
It opens nationwide September 6th.
Nice.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Corinne.
Thank you.
Corinne Van Dusen joins us every other Wednesday for our entertainment report.
After the break, on The Buzz with Nasreen today, she's going to talk about a pioneering project of a pig to human kidney transplant that was performed in the U.S. Whoa. We're going to find out more about that after the break on Kelly and Rumia.
Keep it here for more of Kelly and Ramya on AMI TV.
Welcome back. It's Kelly and Ramya on AMI TV, AMI audio, as well as podcast available. We're available on podcasts as a full show, as well as segments, which you're probably aware of if you're already listening to us on podcast. Grant Hardy, Rumia Umadhin, we're hosting the show today. Let's get into The Buzz. Beth Deer, who usually joins us, is away. So we've got Nasreen Abdelmajid joining us and filling in. You've got some fun articles for us, Nes.
I do. It's always fun.
Yeah, it is always fun. You're right.
The first article we have is a bit wild. A groundbreaking transplant surgery was conducted at Massachusetts General Hospital, where a 62-year-old man suffering from end-stage kidney disease underwent a pioneering surgery. In this surgery, the patient, Richard Slayman, received a kidney from a pig that had been genetically modified, so they removed genes that could be harmful to a human and added certain human genes to improve compatibility. The patient, Richard Slayman, is recovering very well, and this implant offers hope for addressing the worldwide organ shortage, because we are going through that, and experts are expecting more advancements in the future. So I think this is very hopeful. I mean, I can't imagine what the patient must have felt before the procedure, because that, I think, it's pretty scary. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. This has never been done before, not successfully anyway. So it's pretty wild.
Well, yeah. So the interesting part is, to me, the way we're going with this is that kidney transplants have become quite common in North America, and even,
relatively, like, you're on lists, of course, waiting lists and things like that, but even just to get kidney donors and like that process of figuring out mm-hmm. who the kidney is coming from and the compatibility and all of this stuff is quite advanced. Like we're very familiar with that, but yet we're continuing with these organ donations and organ transplant conversations and with science to continue progressing, I guess, to make it more easily available, easily attainable, and to see if we can continue advancing to make it just a bit more, I guess, better for the patient. Mm-hmm. But that means kind of starting from scratch all over again, right, guys? Like, we, just because it's a familiar surgery and procedure and protocol doesn't mean that now that it's a pig's kidney, we just kind of go for it the same way.
Yeah. Oh, it's different. I mean, they modified the kidney, so they made it, like just modifying the kidney so that they could remove genes that could be harmful, like, so there's no harm to the patient. So that is fascinating within itself. So crazy. We're gonna move to the second article. Oh, sorry, you had a thought?
Oh, no, that's okay. No, I was just gonna say I find it interesting how willing people are to just try new things with kind of the only bodies we have, even if the risk for like grave injury or possibly death is very high. Like I was reading about, I think it's C-sections, which was a procedure that in the beginning was almost certainly grave injury or death to yourself until we sort of got it to the point where it was really safe. And like, yeah, it's just amazing.
It's pretty common.
Yeah, no, exactly. But it's amazing where we have to I guess start from, and the amount that people will tolerate to try and advance medical procedures a bit.
Yeah, I think with like, you know, such a successful procedure like this one, and it's rare, it's amazing how much we can do now. You know what I mean? Like I think it opens up doors. It opens up a possible solution for this worldwide shortage of organs. So I think it's a start of something bigger. That's what it is.
All right, let's move on and talk about your second topic.
Oh yeah, so the struggle is real when you're at the airport and you have to make sure every bottle of liquid is under 100 milliliters, whether it's your perfume, deodorant, foundation, lotion. It's hard to keep track of it all, and let's be honest, it's pretty annoying. But finally, Birmingham City Airport is stepping up to become one of the first major British airports to scrap the 100 milliliter rule starting June 1st of this year. Oh. And this decision comes after installing scanners that use an advanced X-ray technology to create a 3D scan of carry-on bags, and that will improve threat detection algorithms. Passengers will no longer need to watch out for the 100 milliliter limit or remove large electronic devices from their bags during security checks. So from what it sounds like, it's going to be like a smooth checkout, check security. So I think this is, it's finally happening. It's finally, it's one airport, but it's finally
just happening. One airport. I airport. Really? It's not there. Even in Canada. Okay.
I know. No, and but they're talking about like the other airports in the UK, you know, just following their footsteps. And I'm like, okay, move it to Canada too. Like that would be
ASAP. Grant, you wanted to say something first?
Do you guys ever get sketched out? Sorry, this is a little off color, but do you guys ever get kind of creeped out by like the amount that X-ray machines,
I was gonna go there,
you know, can see, and like the amount of privacy that all of us are getting giving up just to random employees at the airport? Is that sketchy?
Yeah,
it is very sketchy. Yes, I feel what you're feeling. I understand where you're coming from. Sketchy, but if it makes my If it makes if my it security means I can carry check my a little smoother.
Full shampoo bottle, please.
Full shampoo bottle. Oh my God, I hate buying new shampoo when I get to a location.
How many 100 mils do I got to take on my all-inclusive to bring my shampoo necessary? And no, and truly, like, the, what I was thinking, Grant, not in the same vein, but kind of, was like, wow, we can just immediately get these x-ray machines as needed at airports, but, you know, we're waiting years for x-rays and other imaging for actual medical purposes, which is kind of to me. But anyways, the give and take, as you say, like giving away of privacy, but I think it's not just on the individual level, but I think traffic and check-in time and how long it actually takes to go through security will be minimized with stuff like this. You just kind of walk through. But really, really though, like if they're saying we don't have to deal with this as a terror effect anymore, and that's why we're letting people go through with the x-ray machines, why can't we just go back to the drawing board and just think about that all together? You know, should we really be checking liquids and gels the way we have been? Like, is the terror threat that real in that aspect of security? I don't know. I'm just
I guess that's kind of
one
what I'm
or two people
yeah.
that ruined it for all of us.
Right.
That's what it
well,
is.
Yeah. That's what I'm wondering. Is like, are we going based on like a data centric approach,
right?
Or is there still a lot of security theater, or just sort of just fear? You know, it's funny. I used to have, we had an excellent family friend from another culture, super nice guy, like incredibly just really good guy. And he mentioned like every time he went to an airport, like I think because of his name, you know, he would get harassed, stopped, screened extra, you know, held. And like, it's not that like not only a terrible world, but also just not good security. Like it's fear based rather than like data based, right?
Absolutely, so much bias. Yeah.
It's horrible. Like the amount of security, like even going through the scanner, and I'm all good. They have to check like under my hijab if anything's in there or something like that. I get questioned. It's a whole thing. But back to the liquid limit. What bugs me is that even like when you have liquid that's under 100 mil, you still have to put it in a clear bag.
Yes.
And not just any clear bag, the clear bags that they have at the airport. And it,
you gotta take it out separately. And
like if you're going on a long trip, I'm sorry, I do carry a lot of makeup, so I'm like, okay, is this powder, is this cream, is this cream counted as liquid?
Yeah, like deodorant you mentioned, right? Gels, and like, does this count as this or that? And then they just randomly throw in the laptop batteries and they say, hey, you don't have to take your laptop out anymore either. So why are we categorizing all this stuff into the same thing? Just be like, yep, you're getting x-rayed, just walk on through.
So extra.
And I'm realizing actually that those x-ray machines you mentioned may just x-ray your baggage and your liquid, so it may not actually be giving up as much privacy as I thought when I first heard this.
That's fair. But then again, there's other things that have come up around that as well, right? Like walking through.
100%
x-ray.
100%. So all moving to article three, we're gonna stick to the airport topic, because Wycliffe Fluorizard, a 26-year-old man from Texas, is under federal investigation for allegedly boarding a Delta Airlines flight at Salt Lake International Airport without a proper ticket. Fluorizard reportedly went to a Delta gate where he was seen taking pictures of other passengers' boarding passes, and he used his phone when boarding the plane, and when crew members discovered that he did not have a legitimate boarding pass for the Delta flight, the plane returned to the gate and he was apprehended by law enforcement. Fluorizard allegedly admitted to authorities that he had made a mistake and was, quote, only trying to get home. He faces one federal charge for stowing away on an aircraft. And this incident marks the second instance this year of a person attempting to board a plane without a ticket, after a woman was able to bypass a TSA security checkpoint at Nashville International Airport, and they did successfully board a flight to Los Angeles without a boarding pass in February. which is crazy. I didn't know that was possible.
Like, I was going to say, I'm not even super surprised, to be honest with you. Like, now, really? Yes, because now how efficiently, if you will, you can just kind of glide through the airport without even necessarily talking to another human being. Like, you can go through the kiosks, check in, right, using your passport, ID, whatever. You get a printed boarding pass, then you tap that boarding pass here and there. Through security is where you're actually interacting with human beings. Mm. But other than that, like, you could really get away with stuff like this. I'm super not surprised. And like you said, in this case, you can use your phone as your boarding pass now. They don't even require you to use an actual physical printed out at the airport pass. So, like, there's all these different versions of you being able to check in. And, you know, if I'm just, like, showing you my phone, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And remember the time, too? Oh, my gosh, I'm ranting about this. But remember the time, too, where you were wearing masks all through airports for several years and they just kind of quickly say, hey, pull your mask down so we can check that it's you? Okay, cool. Boom, boom, done. Like, you're not even really identity checking anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They don't, like, scan your face like they used to very much. You know what I mean? Mm. So
it's amazing people would mess with this at all. Oh. It's a big criminal thing, airports.
Yeah, but come on.
It's not, I don't want to say they have guts, but, like, I would be scared to death to try this.
I'm not sure exactly how he made it all the way through and then at the gate started taking pictures. Like, how did you make it all the way through without a boarding pass?
Yeah.
That makes me wonder. Yeah. All right. Nez, we got to go. Thank you. We'll chat with you tomorrow.
Thank you so much. Yeah, for sure.
Nisreen's back for the buzz tomorrow, so stick around for more of that article talk on tomorrow's show. But in the second hour of today's show, we've got HR partner for a firm, business partner, Alicia Yardley, joining us, talking about performance reviews at work. Also, we're talking or going back into the archives and revisiting a conversation Ryan Huey had with legendary radio host Alan Cross. And after the break, community reporter Vic Pereira joins us with news from Winnipeg, Manitoba. We'll be right back.
Keep it here for more of Kelly and Ramya on AMI TV.
Welcome back and welcome to hour two of Kelly and Ramya. Grant Hardy and Ramya Amuthan, we're hosting the show today. I wanted to say quick condolences. A community member, someone from Toronto who people might know very well as the president of the Hands of Fire group, Alicia Modeste, passed away over the weekend. And a huge, great loss to the community. She was an incredible person, was going through some illnesses during the latter part of her life, but still made it out to as many social engagements, especially the Toronto Visionaries engagements, as she possibly could. And she will be missed. So, you know, may she rest in peace. And her family, her mother, Bernadette, who's also very well known in the community and shows up to everything that Alicia showed up to, is here. And I'm sure their family will appreciate any support. If you know Alicia, you know she was always just an absolute light at anything that she came out to. So we'll miss you, Alicia. And thank you for everything you were present for. I will hand things over to you, Grant.
Yeah, thanks for sharing, Ramya. And we will carry on the show, but definitely condolences to her family, and really sorry to hear that news. It is time for our community report now, as we do this time every Wednesday. And today we are going to Vic Pereira in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Hey, Vic, welcome to the program.
Hello, I'm Ian Grant. Good to see you again.
Hey, Vic.
Mm-hmm. I actually got the weekday correct this time. I think last time you came on, I wished you like a happy Monday or something, and it was Wednesday. So there you go. We're already looking up. So we got a couple of hot topics. This first one is really interesting. There's a volunteer recruitment event, I believe, with quite a lot of not-for-profits looking to get people involved. Do you want to tell folks about that?
Sure. It's going to be at the Viscount Gorge Hotel. Volunteer Manitoba is putting on this recruitment event where there's going to be over 50 not-for-profit agencies, because even though they find that the number of volunteers in Manitoba is slowly trending upward, which is a good thing, but it still has not reached the pre-pandemic levels. So a lot of organizations are struggling because they need more people to help deliver their services. So we're hoping that this recruitment event will help find somebody out there who is willing to offer up some of their time to do some tutoring, or deliver some meals, provide some peer support. And I guess there's even opportunities to volunteer remotely now as well. So that it's going to be a good event and well and long overdue, and it's needed.
Yeah, I'll say, you know, the truth of the matter is volunteering can be tough. It's something I would like to do a lot more, but it's just hard to kind of be aware of like what's out there, you know, like all you can do is kind of Google like volunteer in whatever area. So
yeah,
this strikes me as actually really beneficial, kind of like a catch all event with hopefully as many organizations as possible. And I think you mentioned also volunteering boosts people's mental well-being, and that's one of the key messages that they're also sharing here.
Yeah, it's very good to get out there, make connections, even for young people or people who may not be in the job market any longer but still want to get back into it. I know personally, I've always volunteered, you know, ever since I was a teenager, it seems. And I made a lot of good friends through different volunteer work. I've had great opportunities just through volunteering. Mm-hmm. And it's helped me quite a bit.
And actually, that's a good point, too, because when you're younger, you're kind of, you're always somehow involved with volunteering, because through school, you know, you're kind of dedicated to that 40 hours you need to get or however many, and then you kind of go through different phases of that, but you might lose touch with volunteering at some point as well. So to kind of get back into that community awareness and connection, something like this would be fantastic as like a leap back into it. Any particular, go ahead.
Oh, no, what were you going to ask?
I was just going to say, any particular kinds of volunteering that you guys feel would be, you know, up your alley, or the opposite, something that would be very challenging, but you'd love to get supported to try out?
A few years ago, when the Canadian Canada Summer Games were held here in Winnipeg, I volunteered. I decided get a little bit out of my comfort level. Mm-hmm. And I was working the volleyball venue, providing snacks and drinks and food to the athletes. And it involved, you know, going down to wherever the kiosk were, loading up the cart, coming back, and then continuously going back and forth to make sure that the athletes participating in the events at that venue were always supplied and always had something they wanted. And I was a little bit hesitant because I said it was out of my comfort zone, because I've done a lot of board work and tutoring on, you know, JAWS, iOS, NVDA, those types of things. So this was different, but I enjoyed it, and I'm going to look forward to doing some more of that. You know, maybe Save Our Seine, maybe planting trees, you know, along the Seine River Valley. Who knows what I might find there.
Very cool.
Cool. And this is Thursday, April 4th, correct? From 11 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Yeah, and the Viscount Court is on Portage Avenue. It's easily accessible by public transit, and if people drive, there's lots of parking available. So it's a great central location.
Okay. Brilliant. Thank you for that. Let's talk about VIRN, V-I-R-N. They're running a trivia night.
They are, the Vision Impaired Resource Network. They had one in November, which I talked about four or five months ago.
Yep.
And apparently feedback was overwhelming, and they want to do it again. People want to come back. My team, I think, were tied for fifth or sixth, but I've assembled another team again to go to this event at Devil May Care Brewery. And hopefully we might climb up to fourth or third.
And what does it include? Like there's a fee to sign up, right?
Yes, there's a fee to sign up because all proceeds go to VERN, which is a charitable not-for-profit that provide services for people with vision impairments, anywhere from peer support to, you know, tutoring, as we mentioned before, active living, those types of activities. And with that, you get a drink from the bar, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, depending on your preferences. There'll be snacks available. So it's, and anything over and above that goes directly to support VERN.
Fantastic.
I totally dig these types of fundraisers. It's the top idea, I think, for fundraisers. I think sometimes musical performances at a bar or a restaurant can be tough because it's hard to talk. I really like the trivia night vibe because it's just a great opportunity to raise money, but also get to know people, but still have something that's relatively structured. So you don't have just hours where you're trying to, you know, figure out what to talk about. I totally dig this. I'm glad they're bringing this back.
And maybe next time they'll do it sooner.
Microbreweries have a different vibe than your typical bar. You know, they don't have, you know, video lottery terminals and a lot of loud music going on. It's more of a, you know, quiet family atmosphere too.
It is, actually. You're right about that. And I was going to say, back to trivia nights, you know, there's the Toronto Visionaries, who I shouted out right at the start of the segment, as chapter of the CCB. They run trivia nights like every month because it's so popular. And people show up every single time. Like, I'm talking regular teams of 6 or 8 or 10, perhaps. So, like, if there's a demand for this with VERN, they could run this quite regularly, especially with the collaboration of this microbrewery and just in general with other venues.
That explains why the feedback was so overwhelming. If the Visionaries have it happening every month.
Well, people are competitive and love trivia. I am not one of those, though.
Oh, interesting. I was trying to think. I felt like I would be more sort of like chill vibes, you know, whatever. I thought you, Ramya, might be a little more competitive, but I may have.
Competitive, yeah, but not trivia. This is like Harry Potter. Oh, we both do well at Harry Potter.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about this quickly. Japanese Cultural Center of Manitoba Curling Fun Spiel. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, it's a fun spiel. This is rather interesting because my wife is in a mixed rec league and I've spared for that mixed rec league. So she wanted to take kendo, so she joined up with the Japanese Cultural Association of Manitoba, which is run out of the Japanese Cultural Center of Manitoba. And there was a fun spiel taking place and she signed us up. And because we have the family membership, I am now a member of the Japanese Cultural Association of Manitoba.
Nice.
So we each have our own team. I'm not skipping because that's not where my talents lie. I'm going to be lead on my team and she'll have her team. There's 16 involved. Chances are we will play each other. So speaking of being competitive, we'll see what happens at the end of that. And because it's not safe for me to sweep, and I don't want to burn a rock, I can do an in-hack delivery. I do have a friend who's going to come to sweep in my place. So that's how we do it in the mixed directly when I spare as well. So I deliver the stone and usually try to get it in front of the house or just inside the house. Mm. And when it's my turn to sweep, my volunteer sweeper steps in for me. So this is again in support of the Japanese Cultural Association of Manitoba.
Fantastic. And that's Saturday, April 6th. You got a busy April. All these events are coming up quick, but it's glad that Manitoba and Winnipeg, you guys seem to be off on the right track for spring with lots of cool stuff to do.
Yeah, there is. And it's also nice because, you know, similar to what you're experiencing there, I think spring is here. It's kind of struggling a little bit. It dipped a little bit below seasonal. And
We're getting there.
Everything's getting warmer, so it's going to be nice.
Exactly. Vic, we're out of time, but always great to chat with you.
Okay, have a good afternoon.
Cheers. It's Vic Pereira, community reporter for Winnipeg.
And we have all our community reports Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays to kick off the second hour. So check in on us while we check in on people around the country. After the break, we're going into the archives of KNR and we're visiting or revisiting a conversation Ryan Huey had with legendary radio host Alan Cross. It was a really good one. So we want you to listen back with us as we will after the break on Kelly and Ramia.
Don't go away. There's more great conversation with Kelly and Ramia right around the corner.
It's Kelly and Ramia on AMI TV, AMI audio and podcasts. We're going to go back into the archives. Now, this might feel a little strange because it is a Wednesday show and we're going back to a Friday conversation, but it was a really good one. So stick around and listen. On February 16th of this year, Ryan Huey from our chatty bookshelf interviewed legendary radio host Alan Cross. And we're going to check out the conversation right now.
Now, the most important part, have I got a guest for you? He is the producer and the host of one of my favorite podcasts right now called Uncharted, Crime, Murder, and Mayhem in the Music Industry. And it's fantastic. He might be most known for, his radio show called The Ongoing History of New Music. And he's been influential across so many radio stations across Canada, and he's been on the air since 1980 and he's not going anywhere, but has he got a story for you? Welcome in, chatty bookshelf lovers, the Mr. Man himself, Alan Cross. How are you, Alan? And thank you for joining us.
Welcome. I'm a huge audiobook consumer. I mean, ridiculously huge. So this is kind of fun.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm always glad to hear. Maybe we'll have to chat about some recommendations and then I'll bring them here and let everyone know. But obviously I'm a huge fan of Uncharted. So for the people, the audience out there that might not have tuned in, can you give us maybe 25 second or 30 second, I know that's going to be difficult, synopsis of what you got going on there with Uncharted, the great podcast?
Actually, it's not that complicated at all. The true crime genre is the biggest in the podcasting world. So I wanted to get a piece of that. So Uncharted, Crime and Mayhem in the Music Industry is all about the intersection of crime, true crime, and also music. So the music industry is a very, very swampy place, and a lot of weird things have happened over the decades. And this podcast examines some of the things that have happened and the characters that made it happen and the people that paid the price.
I've listened and tuned into every single episode so far, and my favorite is about the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash. What was it like citing such an iconic moment in music history? How did you go about, you know, choosing that episode and doing all of the research for that?
Well, this was brand new, so I started with the things that I knew a little bit more about, and one of the things I knew quite a bit about was the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash in October 1977, because I was around back then. I was a Lynyrd Skynyrd fan, and I remembered the reports on television and on radio, and I thought, okay, if we're going to do something that involves, I don't know if there's crime, mayhem, which made it certainly a viable topic for the program. And, you know, the deeper you get into it, the weirder the story becomes. I mean, here's a rock band at the height of their powers who gets on a rickety aircraft with a couple of pilots who didn't bother to check the fuel levels and weren't exactly concerned about safety on a bunch of different levels. And this plane goes down in a swamp and a number of people died, the pilots and three members of the band and some people in the crew. And there were a lot of horrific injuries there. And then when people
right
found
at the height of them at the height of Lynyrd Skynyrd too, as well. It's one of my favorites for sure.
And when people heard about the plane crash, they came out of the Mississippi hinterlands and basically looted the plane and what was left, including purses and wallets. It's just a crazy story.
I And there's your crime, right? If you're looking for crime, maybe we're just looking in the wrong places there. But just building on that a little bit more, so all of your episodes are about half an hour to the 45-minute range. And I don't want you to give away any secrets, but, you know, including research and producing it and getting it up on podcatchers everywhere. How long does it usually take for you to kind of go from nothing to a finished product kind of thing?
Well, the program comes out every 2 weeks, and each script is somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 words, which is a lot. So I would say that the whole thing, each episode takes me 10 or 12 hours, I think, something along those lines. Wow. Now, that doesn't count the stuff that I'm gathering, the research that I'm gathering, you know, between shows, because I'm always looking for information. I'm always looking for topics. And that means, you know, having to write, read a book or to dig into some magazine archives or something like that, which I will do when I have a moment long before I actually start writing the program. And what I tend to do is write the show and then go back and augment certain parts, add additional information, create additional imagery, that kind of thing. So I fill it out after I've written the first draft. And that's what everybody gets to hear.
And that kind of, I've had some narrators for audiobooks, some audio performers there, and they said it's about, for every hour they have to record, it's about 8 hours. So the story checks out there. And in our audience, we might have some young folks or some old folks in the audience that really want to get in the podcast or the radio industry. What's one thing you know now that you wish you knew when you started out in 1980? If you can narrow it down to one.
Well, the issue is that radio has changed dramatically since over the last 44 years. And that's because back in the day, radio was one of the few entertainment choices you had. You had movies, you had television with a limited number of cable channels. You could go to the mall or maybe read a book or a magazine. That was pretty much it. There was no social media. There was no internet. There were video games were something that you paid a quarter for at the arcade that you had to leave the house to play. So radio had a larger share of ear in the early 1980s than it does today. There's so much competition for it. What I can tell you is that radio is still very powerful, very popular, very profitable. It's just not the same as it was 44 years ago because of the way things changed. Now, would I have changed anything? No. I'm pretty pleased and grateful and lucky for the way things have turned out for me. So I don't know if there is anything I would tell my younger self to be out to look out for, simply because it is an industry that involves some bobbing and weaving. I would have probably learned more about computers sooner than I did. And I would probably have kept a closer eye on the internet when it first popped up in the mid-1990s than I did. I mean, okay, a little bit, but we didn't do it enough. And I'm speaking as the industry as a whole. It kind of caught us off guard.
All right. That's a wonderful response. And I hope that others will take that to heart and go out there and get their podcast on, because it's wonderful to get all of these new ones out there. But as a music lover, you have your website, the Journal of All Musical Things. Am I allowed to ask for any favorites? And instead of, you know, hey, what's your favorite song or band? You know, what's your favorite iconic moment in history, if you could choose one? Or what's your favorite era of music, if you could choose?
I would say there was a period between 1989 and 1995. That's my favorite, because if you were into alternative music, new music at the time, every day it seemed that there was a new song, a new band, a new album, new scene, new sound that you had to learn everything about. It was an incredibly fertile time. And it was very, very exciting, because not only did we have the music coming out, we had things changing in terms of popular culture. You know, Lollapalooza came along and Generation X started exerting their influence. And it was just a pretty cool time to be involved in music. So that's my favorite era Although I will tell you this, every generation has a biological right to believe that the music of their youth is their greatest, is the greatest music of all time. So for me, that would be growing up in the 1970s and all the music that was coming out back then. Because when you are young, you use music as a way to figure out who you are. And once you figure out who you are, you then use music to demonstrate and broadcast to the world who you've become as a human being. And you might choose a different team. You might be a country kid, a pop kid, a goth kid, a punk kid, a metal kid, whatever it is. But this music becomes an essential part of your ID. And so with me, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the late 70s that would involve Van Halen and Pink Floyd and Deep Purple and all that kind of stuff that I will still go back to simply because that's 14-year-old me, 15-year-old me, 16-year-old me.
I think we all revisit that. Yeah. Cause I'm the same way and I must be getting old and, you can't go wrong with any of Van Halen. That's for sure.
No. Well, you can, if it's Sammy Hagar, sorry, I'm a David Lee Roth guy.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. So you have no shortage of accomplishments and things that we should be celebrating, with your radio shows, your career in radio, your podcast, the exhibition at the Science Center that you helped curate and were hugely influential on. But what comes next? Can you give us any insight as to Uncharted, or is there anything else you got? What kind of other works you got on the go?
Uncharted is in the process of being optioned for a TV series, which would be pretty cool. It's still very much in the discussion phase. But that's certainly on the table. There's another program that deals with music history and history period that is also on the table. There is another TV show that deals with artists and their first big hits that is being bandied about by some people on both sides of the Atlantic. But I think the next thing that's going to happen for me is I've been hired tentatively to be the music researcher on a Hollywood feature film that will involve the Kent State Massacre of May of 1970. So,
or Dead in Ohio, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. Yeah.
Where it starts. So, 2024 promises to be a pretty busy time outside of just doing radio and podcasts, which will continue. There's no question. Radio and podcasts are the things that that pay the bills. But I'm always looking for new and interesting things to do. And people have approached me with these projects. And it's like, you bet. Yeah. Let's giddy up.
No, and you know what? I could sit here and chat with you. I have so many questions we didn't even get to, but I just really wanted to. We're unfortunately out of time, and I wanted to thank you. And you are now a honored member of the Chatty Bookshelf. We'll call it society or guest list, and just you're welcome back anytime. If you want to tell people where they can get their hands on, you can get your hands on Uncharted anywhere that you get your podcast from. But if you have handles that you want to follow Alan on, if you want to shout those out, because I know I follow you on Twitter.
Sure. Twitter X, whatever Elon Musk
right.
has ruined.
Yes.
It's at Alan Cross, ALANCROSS. I have my email is alan@alancross.ca. I answer every email myself. There's The Ongoing History of New Music, which is a podcast, Uncharted, we talked about. And I also have a website, ajournalofmusicalthings.com. And from there, you can get to my Facebook page and Instagram and whatever else I feel I need to do with social media.
Well, thank you so much. Everybody check out Uncharted, the podcast. You won't regret it. I mean, if they're making it into a TV show, then that's just like our audiobooks that are made into movies. They don't just choose anything. They got something good here. So thank you so much, Alan. I really appreciate the time.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
What a fantastic interview. Yeah, that was incredible. And of course, some more content for you to check out. If you want to go back and listen to any part of that, that was Ryan Huey's interview with Alan Cross, and it aired on Friday, February 16th. So you can go back. It's still available, at least for the next little while, the Chatty Bookshelf episode with that interview on your favorite podcast platform. After the break, we're going to be dispelling the anxieties around performance reviews at work with AMI's HR business partner, Alicia Yardley. She's going to be here with us. So stick around. It's Kelly and Rumia.
It's fun, insightful, and inclusive. Kelly and Rumia return in a minute.
It's Kelly and Rumia. Thanks for sticking around here. We're in the middle of hour two, give or take, getting ready for another conversation, one of several conversations we have here on the show every weekday. 2 p.m. Eastern time is when you can catch us live on AMI TV. Grant Hardy and myself, Rumia Amudin, are hosting today, and we're going to check in with Alicia Yardley from our Human Resources Department here at AMI to talk a little work.
Hi, I'm Alicia Yardley, your HR specialist. Join me for career and employment advice right here on Kelly and Rumia.
Alicia, today we're talking about something near and dear to our hearts here at AMI. The performance review. But really, we're talking about performance management here. So what exactly is it?
So performance management, the formal definition is the process of continuous communication and feedback between an employee and manager towards the achievement of organizational objectives. So in plain English, it really is employees and managers working together to know whether employees are doing the work they're supposed to be doing at the level they're supposed to be doing it, how employees are doing overall in their role. And almost every organization has some form of performance management or another, whether it is, you know, a formal process like, you know, in a bank perhaps, or an informal process like, you know, startup potentially, but they all, almost all of them have some form.
Yeah.
Why should employees care, aside from just not wanting to invoke the wrath of their employer perhaps, but in general, why should employees care about performance management?
Yeah, it's a question I've gotten many times over my years in HR, and it's really for us, you know, in HR, it is a really good opportunity for employees to measure themselves like against, you know, their use it as a yardstick to measure themselves in terms of how they are doing, to think about development opportunities, their strengths, potentially their areas for improvement. And so it can be, you know, like a point of personal pride if you really want to know where you're excelling, where maybe you need some improvement. It is really good to care about performance management. And also performance management is really tied to your, what we call employee life cycle. So that's, you know, performance management is tied to training and development opportunities for you, whether there's a promotion, you know, in some organizations. And so it is a really relevant concept to every employee.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair, right? Like to have something that you can regularly check in on for accountability, but also just as reminders to, I guess, different like milestones and such, and keep track of how things are going. And it can feel very supportive to have it. So what are different performance management programs or tools that people can use?
Yeah, so different organizations do different things. Some performance management systems are like, some companies do what we call pay for performance. And so you're rated, and that is directly tied to your salary increase the following year, or directly tied to a bonus potentially. Some organizations don't do pay for performance. A lot of nonprofits do not. The government does not. But Yeah, so there are like different kinds of performance management tools. One of the performance management tools everybody's aware of is a performance review or performance appraisal. And then there are, you know, conversations to be had. So if you're ever like concerned about your own performance or you want to talk to your manager, that's part of performance management.
Hey, let's delve right into the performance review slash appraisal, and let's talk a little bit about that as a tool, what it is, why it's useful.
Yeah, so performance management is like, as I said, it's kind of that overarching concept. A performance review or a performance appraisal is something that you complete as part of performance management. Usually they are set at set times during the year, whether it's the fiscal year or the calendar year. Usually companies will do a like beginning of the year objective setting meeting, and then a mid-year, and then a year end. Some companies might do it slightly differently. Some performance reviews are a little bit more employee driven, where employees are saying, you know, here's what I want to do to contribute to the department, to align with our departmental objectives and what the department wants to accomplish. Some of them, it's very top down. So your manager is saying you need to be doing this year. And it's something that you complete and you talk to your manager about during those set times.
So you talked about the two different kind of approaches, right, to performance management, one of them being tied to your salary and the other one not necessarily. So is that the direct correlation for why employees would be graded, the incentive?
Yeah, not always.
Okay.
It's funny. I have a friend who was saying to me, he said to me like a few times, you know, if I knew that I would be basically getting like grades, like a report card as an adult, I probably would never start working. And it's, yeah. And I know a lot of people feel like they're being graded. It's really, you know, it's not a referendum on you as a person, or usually even you as an employee. It's really, you can use that as of course, part of pay for performance. But it's even just as like a point of, you know, pride or a yardstick. So maybe somebody that wants to learn a new skill, they can see how they're doing in picking up that skill. You know, for example, like budgeting, or, you know, you're trying to learn a different kind of software or a soft skill like communication skills. You can see how you're doing. You can see how you're developing, what development opportunities might still be available to you. So it's not just grades connected to money all the time. It is connected to a point of personal pride as well.
No, it's interesting, right? Because I feel like because work, you know, literally takes up the majority of our adult waking lives, we often talk to our colleagues more than our families. I would imagine you have some people that just kind of like, I clock in and do my thing, clock out. You probably have a lot of people who these grades are really tied into their sense of self, like their sense of sort of competence about themselves as a person related to their lives, right? Wonder how you can kind of separate that out a bit. But I guess it's like you said, just remembering that it's more just a reflection of your current position in your company and how you're doing in relation to the rest of your company.
I would agree. It is very hard to separate for a lot of us. You know, I've been doing HR for a while. I understand all the concepts, and there's some feedback that I will still internalize and, you know, not take personally, but kind of be like, oh, I thought I was better at this. And then I, you know, use it as a referendum on me. So it is very hard to separate those things. But, you know, ideally, that's why your manager should be skilled in having those kinds of conversations. And you should be talking about like your performance as an employee, not you, like in general, not, you know, and you're never going to improve. It's all about the communication with a performance review. One of the big things we say in HR is that you should never be surprised about your rating or what your manager has to say. If you're going into a performance review conversation and you're shocked by your rating, either your manager is really not communicating or maybe there's been a disconnect between the two of you. But that is a problem. And so for people, like, they should be having these conversations with their managers, and their managers should be meeting with them kind of throughout the year informally. And you know, you should have a sense of sort of where you're at. I think that helps to separate, you know, the referendum on you as a person, because you're absolutely right, Grant. It is a part of a lot of our identities.
Yeah, and a lot of the times you're the one creating these benchmarks for yourself anyway, right? These goals and places you want to go, or improvement, I guess. And it comes down to the value that you have with work as well. So it's interesting to maintain this relationship and continue it, as you said, throughout the year, Alicia. But question, like, if you're new to, let's say, a particular workplace or company and new to performance management in this way, what happens? You know, should we be worried about how to do it, how I'm going to be graded, you know, graded badly?
Yeah, and that can be a real concern for people. Let's say you just moved into a new role or you've started a new job. Let's say, you know, we're having a mid-year conversation in March, you started in January. Nobody's going to expect you to be like fully performing at that point, hopefully. You know, you're still learning the role, and obviously that's going to differ from company to company. But, you know, I mean, people are aware that there's always going to be a learning period. And your manager, again, that's part of that conversation that you and your manager should be having when you start. And then as part of the mid-year, just even to say, okay, it's been, you know, like 2 months in this role. How do you think I'm doing? What am I doing well? Is there anything I could take away to work on that you've noticed? So I think that is you know, really important as well. But again, a lot of this is just informal conversation between a manager and an employee, and you know, making sure that you are made aware of, like, very clearly what the expectations of you are going to be. And with that, don't be afraid to ask questions. It can feel a little bit intimidating, of course, like, to, you know, go to your manager and say, you know, I want to talk to you about how I'm doing, because I think some of us are afraid that the feedback's going to be bad. But I think it is good to get the information, you know, and then at least you've got it and then you know what to do with it. And again, you know, your manager is the one grading you, but just to also bear in mind that is one person's opinion, you know, and they should have at least facts to back up what they're saying. But if there are ever concerns about, you know, your performance rating or the performance expectations, you can always talk to HR, and that's a conversation that HR can have with you as well.
Well, it's like what you said, right? It shouldn't shock you, the kind of feedback that you're getting, because you should already be aware of how you're doing, what that improvement may look like and feel like for you, and the kinds of supports that you need. Sorry, Grant, you were going to say?
Exactly. A similar along kind of those lines. I was wondering, you know, looking back to being graded in school, which you mentioned earlier, I guess a lot of it is still a little bit subjective, but in theory, you know, you should be able to kind of get your assignment maybe regraded by someone else and come up with the same or a similar mark. But I'm wondering, in the workplace, do you see it more commonly where maybe your kind of personal relationships within your company make your grading a little more subjective, or is it the kind of thing that is relatively objective and consistent across the board, or a combination?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's part of my role in HR, that's really what HR should be doing, is making sure that it's objective, because absolutely, you're right. You know, I might be graded by my boss as like, you know, outstanding, and then she leaves and somebody else comes in and I'm suddenly like, you know, needing improvement because the expectations are different. So, you know, HR really should be looking at the performance reviews, having conversations with managers. Some companies will do what they call calibration, where all of the managers will sit together and discuss, you know, their employees, what they've rated them, and make sure that everybody is on the same page. So what is an outstanding look like? What is, like, you know, the average? What is in needing improvement, so that it is more objective? You know, manager people are going to be people. There are many ways that people can show biases. You know, research has shown that people are going to be easier on people that they, you know, relate to in some way, or that they feel like is like them. Or, you know, there's so many ways that you can show bias. And so part of HR's job is to make sure that that's like kept as, you know, as down as possible, like so that it is a lot more objective.
Yeah. Well, this has been very insightful, especially for people who might be completely new to this concept. Alicia, thank you.
You are welcome. Thanks for having me.
Alicia Yardley joins us on the fourth Wednesday of every month to talk a little employment and an HR perspective, because she is our HR business partner. So we'll check back in with her in April. We tend to have a lot more employment conversations around this time of the day on Wednesdays anyway. After the break, we're going to tell you what's coming up on Now with Dave Brown Thursday morning. Also, you feel like you're too old for some of the stuff that you've lived with for a very long time. A bunch of people on BuzzFeed gave their thoughts about what they're way too old for and will not put up with anymore. So we'll find out about that after the break as well.
We'll be back with more of Kelly and Ramya after this short break.
As we wrap the show here, it's a very interesting show today on Kelly and Ramya. Lots of different conversations that you can reflect back on if you were already here checking it out with us. But also you can go back and listen to, if you haven't already, by using your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere, so just search for Kelly and Ramya and you will find us. And there's a lot going on. There's always archives and archives of us on your favorite podcast platform as well. Grant Hardy, Ramya Amuddin, and as I said, we're capping up things here, but before we go, a couple things. Number one, let's see what's coming up on Now with Dave Brown tomorrow morning. That's our morning show on AMI TV at 9 a.m. Eastern time every weekday. And Grant, you have a bit of a teaser of what they have planned?
Sure. Well, as you know, people with disabilities use social media to tell their stories. And actor Sofia Sanchez had a post go viral where she discussed the assumptions people make about Down syndrome. Alice Grace is going to offer her thoughts on that viral video tomorrow morning show. Plus, Mark Aflalo from Access Tech Live will tell us about Apple users targeted in advanced phishing attacks involving password reset requests. Scary stuff. And on a lighter note, we're going to have Laura Bain with the Entertainment Report. That's tomorrow. Now with Dave Brown.
Thank you. Let's look to BuzzFeed for some very key commentary about a very interesting or, you know, important topic. We're getting older, right? And we keep talking about it. Like, everybody keeps bringing up the fact that, you know, we're not young people anymore, Grant. Whatever. But anyways, there's a thread going on here, and I thought it was just absolutely relatable and hilarious. It's called "I'm 37 and I'm not and I'm beyond over it. Older adults are revealing the things that they're too old to deal with anymore." And as I said, it's BuzzFeed stuff. So basically, I handpicked a couple of these responses about what people feel they're way too old to deal with nowadays, and even shorten some of them just for condensing sake. And here are some of them, okay? So I don't do anything recreational anymore. If I'm not enjoying myself, if I'm not into a movie or show, I turn it off. If I'm not having fun at a party, I leave. That one went on to say that she left a wine tasting thing with her friends because they were talking about someone behind their back. She's like, I'm out of here. So anyways, that's Sarah Short Health. I'm in my late 40s now, and unlike my younger self, I don't seek out friends. If a friendship happens organically, great. If not, I don't care how cool, rich, popular, or connected you are. That's from J-Mox Jr. Are we still trying to make friends, Grant? I'm definitely not.
Yeah, I could use some some more friends for sure. But I dig the thing about there's, you know, all that etiquette you've heard around, like, if you don't finish, you know, the last paragraph of a book, whatever, you can't say, like, oh, I read Pride and Prejudice. No.
Yeah,
if I don't like it and I'm 50% done, I'm going to slam that shot.
Gosh, yeah. Found a person on TikTok who was just like, I just pick it up in the middle. I'm like, what? Okay. Never again will I buy a pair of jeans that do not stretch or have to be broken into for weeks to fit me. They'll have to pry my denim spandex pull-ons from my dying hands. Donna Parks, I am with you. I can't even go back to jeans properly after the sweats era of the pandemic. I don't even bother with social media. I don't post pics of my vacation or anything else exciting going on in my life. I don't need validation from others. As I learned a long time ago, most people don't really care what you're up to, and it used to be a joke that the worst thing you can do was force people to look at your vacation slides, and I figure I'll be the one person who give other people a break from that torture. Username failed. It was really sad, but I used to pretend I could see people's photos. Like, I had this low vision thing going on where people couldn't really tell what I could see and couldn't see, and sometimes I just didn't want to say whatever, and people will show me their photos, and I was like, oh, cool. Oh, that's so awesome. Oh, thank you. That's, it was very so inauthentic. Sad. I know. I hated it. But nowadays,
the thing about social media, I think it's so bad for our health. It makes everybody miserable, but the only way we try and compensate is by showing everyone that we have absolutely perfect, wonderful, exciting lives. And it just makes everyone else miserable looking at us lying and pretending that we have perfect lives.
Like, we're all in it, but we all know we're faking it, right? I don't waste my time arguing with people in traffic anymore. If you're trying to cut aggressively, just go right ahead. Letting things like this go makes my day better. TMRR15. I will never again pay to attend a concert without seats. Who wants to stand all evening to see an artist perform or sit in some itchy grass? Count me completely out. Lines of Frasier. I totally am on board with that one. Jasmine Sullivan, I love you, but my legs still ache from standing at that 3-hour concert. My goodness. All right, Grant. Let's see what's coming up on tomorrow's show, the Thursday edition of Kelly and Ramia. We have tech expert Mike Fair helping us keep our finances in check with the feature guide of Thin, a free budget tracking app with accessibility and privacy in mind.
Chef Mary Mammoliti shares her advice on combining sweet and savory flavors to serve the ultimate brunch, plus a recipe for a one-pan ham and potato bake.
Join us tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern time on AMI TV for more Kelly and Ramia.
Join us weekly for The Pulse with host Joita Gupta, who brings us closer to issues impacting the disability community across Canada. Watch The Pulse on YouTube or listen wherever you download your AMI podcasts.